Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of January, the day after President Obama's State of the Union address. And that is what we will be talking about this hour of the program. We're delighted to have James Fallows with us this hour. James was live blogging about the address last night, and he wrote an interesting piece in The Atlantic on December 13, that looked at the Obama's presidency. I have a feeling there's a book in the making somewhere down the line here. James is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's written for the magazine since the late 1970s, and he has reported extensively from outside the United States. He was President Carter's chief speechwriter. He is author of a number of books. His latest book is China Airborne, also author of Blind into Baghdad and Postcards from Tomorrow Square. And he's with us this hour to talk about last night and what we all saw and what we all heard from this president. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. James Fallows, always a pleasure to speak with you, sir. Hello.
Kathleen, thanks so much. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. What you're hearing you blogged last night is the 12 years later bookend to the time when Obama first came to national attention with his "We're not red state, blue state, but United States" speech in Boston in 2004. Why was it a bookend?
It was a bookend because the theme that President Obama, then Senate candidate Obama, made in 2004 in Boston was, and that got him national attention, was the idea that the partisan divide, already then being called the red state, blue state divide, could be healed if we thought of ourselves as the United States of America. That was what I think made him appealing as a candidate over the next 4 years between then and his election. And it's what he would like to have been the theme of his time in government. And I think what he's found, in fact, is that it is a quite polarized red state, blue state country. So I think that we saw, as he looks back near the end of his time as a two-term president, what it has been like to govern in these very different circumstances from those he hoped to be the case, and how he's still trying to make the "let's look past the divide, let's look to our common future" argument, knowing how uncommon and non-agreed upon much of the terrain is still these days.
Mm-hmm. He made this interesting comment, which was unusual for him. If I had been a Lincoln, if I had been a Roosevelt, maybe I would be able to have taken on this partisan divide better. Why did he reference those two presidents, and could they have handled this partisan division better than he has?
That was a very interesting line in the speech, one of several interesting lines, I thought, because in one way, there's a kind of annoying faux modesty to say, "Well, I'm no Lincoln, I'm no FDR." You know, choosing the two most eminent leaders in all of American history, or maybe two of the three, along with George Washington. And I think also there was a, if you think about it, there was a falseness to it, a historical falseness, because the assertion was Obama was being modest. If I'd been more gifted, I could have found ways to knit things together. But we do not remember Abraham Lincoln for knitting things together. Mm-hmm. We remember him for presiding over an actual war in which there was a, you know, the greatest divide in American history, and through force of arms, he brought the nation back together, and then, of course, had his healing rhetoric. Franklin Roosevelt, too, was not a conciliator when he was trying to get the New Deal passed. So I thought it was that was the one line that rang to me out of sync with Obama's normal great historical sophistication. He sort of knows better than to make that argument, because neither Lincoln nor FDR at their respective strongest times as leaders were seen necessarily as conciliators.
Mm. So you think that that he actually was saying, really, I am not that bad?
Well, I thought it was, there's a kind of triple backflip difficulty with that line. At first glance, it sounded, you know, historically resonant. Oh, he's looking back in our past. And also sounded somewhat modest. And then if you thought about the modesty, you thought, well, what the hell? It's like saying, well, I play tennis worse than Roger Federer. You know, it's not really that modest. And also on the logic, it was wrong. So that was the one line in the speech that seemed to me out of keeping with the normal sophistication of Obama as a writer and speaker.
And yet when he said that the rancor and the suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better, I think that's probably true, and I wonder why.
It certainly is true, or at least I would assert it's true. And I think there is, maybe when he is out of office, President Obama, ex-President Obama, then will be able to explain more about why he thinks that is the case. For the purposes of this speech, while still in office and while still having to do something with the Republican opposition in the Congress for the next year or so, he has to feign astonishment at what has made the divide more serious. I have reason to believe that his actual view is that the dynamics of the Republican Party in the years since Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy, 40-plus years ago, have had their natural fruition in the candidacies of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, and that there is a kind of logic as opposed to puzzlement to the very, very deep partisan divide of this day.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in a piece for The Atlantic on December 13th titled Obama, Chess Master, Not Pawn. You wrote about three things that has happened under his watch that are significant, and some of those were mentioned in the speech last night. Let's hear what he had to say about climate change last night and then hear what you wrote about the climate agreement in Paris. Here's the president last night.
Look, if anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely because you'll be debating our military, most of America's business leaders, the majority of the American people, almost the entire scientific community, and 200 nations around the world who agree it's a problem and intend to solve it. But even if the planet wasn't at stake, even if 2014 wasn't the warmest year on record, until 2015 turned out to be even hotter, why would we want to pass up the chance for American businesses to produce and sell the energy of the future?
As you wrote in the piece on December 13, James, you write, it's an unbelievable contrast to the utter collapse of the Copenhagen negotiations early in his term.
Yes, and I think that there will be a case that the president is beginning to make himself that looked at if we do the impossible, if we attempt the impossible of saying what is this period in history going to look like from 10 or 20 years' perspective, he's beginning to lay down the argument there have been a number of significant improvements. He made the case that it's been the longest sustained record of job increase in history. Of course, it started with a very severe collapse. But these international agreements, and I mentioned in the piece, as you know, the climate agreement, the rapprochement with Cuba and the Iran deal, each of them required some deftness to do, and I think he is arguing that these will be seen as genuine achievements, much as we look back on John Kennedy with the Test Ban Treaty, on Richard Nixon with the normalization with China. These were things that lasted, made a difference, and were better for the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the article for just a moment. The climate deal, the opening of relations with Cuba. What about this international agreement with Iran? You're going to write about this more extensively, you indicate in this article, keeping Iran at least short-term from developing a nuclear weapon. In the long run, potential of beginning to end Iran's destructive estrangement from the international order. Do you have hopes that that indeed will happen, James?
I think it was important that the Obama administration made the case that the deal itself did not depend on any hope or assumption about what would happen inside Iran or between Iran and the rest of the world over the next generation. They were saying that even if you assumed the worst about Iran's future, it was better to have these kinds of safeguards against its nuclear ambitions than not having them. But they went on to say that the deal would also probably make it more likely for Iran to rejoin the community of nations and its pariah status that it's had since the days when I was working the administration for Jimmy Carter, and there, of course, was the Iranian Revolution. So in the year leading up to the passage of this deal, the fact that the Senate was not able to overturn it, I was arguing that there was the potential in this agreement to remedy, as with Cuba, an aberration in America's relations with the rest of the world, that Iran is not structurally or historically a bitterly anti-American society. The current government is very much anti-American. The society gives very little evidence of that being so. And so if there is some way, like a smaller version of the rapprochement with China under Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. I think that is the upside, the possible upside of this deal.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the speech itself. It was kind of unusual watching it because you're used to the State of the Union being, this is what I want to accomplish, this is what I have accomplished, the list goes on and on. He chose to give a very different kind of State of the Union, I thought. Did you think so?
I sort of thought so. I thought that he chose to present it as a very different kind of State of the Union, saying it's going to be shorter, which it was not.
No, it wasn't.
And it was not going to be a laundry list. But actually, if you listen to it, it was. He said he at surface level, he structured it as these four questions of how we're going to have an inclusive economy and how technology is going to be our friend and some other thing and how we're going to make politics work. And so that was a little different structure, more sort of essay question-like than the normal State of the Union speech. But within each of those four sections, it was your normal laundry list, saying we need to be more inclusive, we need to have a more inclusive economy, therefore pass this, pass that, give me more money for community colleges, et cetera. So I thought it was as good a job as one can possibly do to fight the conventions of the State of the Union address, but those conventions are stronger than you are. Mm-hmm. And those conventions force you to have the laundry list and to have a very long speech.
He gave up on some of the conventions that you blogged about last night were started by Ronald Reagan.
Yes. There are two ways in which I, as a one-time speechwriter, argue that Ronald Reagan, gifted orator, hurt the tradition of presidential oratory. One is, this will sound incredible, but it's actually true. Before Ronald Reagan, presidents did not have to end every single speech on every single topic by saying, and God bless the United States of America. You know, you can look it up. George Washington never said that. FDR didn't. Lincoln didn't. Jimmy Carter didn't. But since Reagan made that the convention, it's like a flag pin. If you don't do it now, you're some kind of commie. And so that's, you know, that's one thing Reagan did. The other thing he did is the so-called Lenny Skutnik moment. This was in the 1982 State of the Union. There'd been a plane crash in the Potomac. A guy named Lenny Skutnik had pulled some people out of the ice-covered river. And Ronald Reagan had him sit in the presidential box next to Nancy Reagan and called him out during the speech. And ever since that time, presidents have had this kind of prop box of people they want to represent some American virtue sitting up there next to the First Lady. And Obama had people there in Michelle Obama's seating area, but he didn't call them out. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an improvement. You have the symbolic value of today's Lenny Skutniks without having to actually do this sort of, to my mind, hokey calling them out. Mm.
And perhaps what was most significant about that box was the empty chair.
Yes, and the fact that Obama, this was actually, I think, a new media shrewdness of Obama, that they knew they could have news stories about the empty chair and its symbolism without his having to say so in the speech.
Right.
So that was the meta chess master skill of getting the message across.
Yeah. You have written, and I'm interested in your experience here, James, when you were working with Carter, you were working on State of the Union speeches. When you were laboring on these, you wrote last night back in the Carter administration, there was a several-hour fight over whether to include a sentence about Bangladesh.
Yes. And the reason these speeches are always so long, the reason their structure is always like a big catalog, you know, the cliche is the laundry list, is because for the entire government, and in fact for the entire world, having some mention in this speech really matters. If the president puts in a sentence about community colleges or about some new attack helicopter or whatever, through the next year, the agency that's promoting that part of the budget can say, well, the president has pointed this out. This is in keeping with the president's wishes. And so because everybody in the world knows this speech is coming as a dead certainty a year ahead of time, they start working 11 and a half months ahead of time to get stuff in there. And I do remember with a long discussion with then close, now unfortunately a deceased friend, of how important it would be to the future of world poverty if President Carter could say something good about Bangladesh.
Oh, my.
And I'm sad to say I can't remember whether it made into the speech or not. I'll have to go look it up.
I guess you will, because now I wonder, James. I wonder.
I'll go look it up.
Thank you. Anyone claiming, he said, America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction. He talked about how strong we are, how many jobs have been created, and then looked at what's happening with technology and what's happening with wages. Do you think that rang true, that people feel that America's economy is really strong right now?
Let me answer that in two ways. First, on the merits, I think it absolutely is true. If you compare the American economy with all of the problems we all know about, of polarization and stagnation and exclusion and everything else we know about, with any other economy on earth, you recognize that anybody else would be so jealous to have our problems. And I can go on at length, but so I think on the merits, it is certainly true. Whether it can be absorbed in a political climate where the essential narrative of the opposition party is that this is the worst things have been in memory and they are getting worse fast, I don't know. And I guess that will be part of the narrative of the election. You know, every election, the opposition, the party that doesn't hold the White House, its main point is things are bad and getting worse. That's gone to a sort of greater pitch of intensity this time. And it's hard for politicians and for journalists, too. It seems kind of embarrassing to make a positive case because people say, well, what about X? What about Y? What about all the things that are wrong? So I think Obama has been trying to say, we know our problems, but let's recognize also our strengths.
Mm-hmm. Some of the comments, direct comments toward Donald Trump and also toward Senator Ted Cruz, Trump's response, isn't this a wonderful combination of words? The State of the Union speech is really boring, slow, lethargic, very hard to watch, just what you would expect Trump to say, although it wasn't that at all. Do you think that he took a lot of aim at both Trump and Cruz and the Republicans here?
He did, and I think I'll do the segue to what you're going to ask about next, which is that Obama did, of course, and that is, in a way, unsurprising because he represents everything that the momentum of the Trump party is now against, mm-hmm. of different kinds of people being part of the American mix, et cetera, et cetera. The more remarkable thing, of course, is that Nikki Haley, the governor, yes. the Republican governor of South Carolina, really twisted the knife in her Republican response. And I thought that she had a much more unconcealedly anti-Trump pitch than President Obama did. I can imagine that some of Donald Trump's supporters thinking, bring it on. This shows that we just have the Democrats who are bad and the rhinos who are just as bad, the Republicans in name only. But I thought that was the news of the night was the tone that Nikki Haley took in that speech.
Who decided that she would give the response, James? Do you know?
My guess is that officially it would have been Rents Priebus and his people from the Republican National Committee. Who that meant in practice, I don't know. I know for a certainty that her speech would not have come as a surprise to mm-hmm. other members of the Republican National Committee. These things are vetted. Probably the most effective Democratic response during George W. Bush's time was by then new Senator James Webb. You know, who ran mm-hmm. for a while this year's nomination and dropped out. And he gave a very tough sort of anti-chicken hawk response to one of George W. Bush's speech. That's the only one I remember as being comparably strong. Bobby Jindal gave a disastrous one a couple of years ago. Usually these are places where careers go to die. But I think that Nikki Haley got some attention and made some news with her speech.
The other thing you couldn't help but think about, and you more than most people when you were looking at this president, is how significant his election was. I kept thinking as I was looking at him and realizing it's his last State of the Union, here's our first African-American president who has faced so many divisions, who's faced Donald Trump saying you're not an American citizen, da-da-da-da, has had so much to deal with, but how significant an event, because he's a two-term president now. He's a significant factor in our history.
Yes, and I think a couple of things. Obviously, we reflect on that as we see him winding up this time. I argued at the time and in the year before his reelection and just after, too, that his reelection was more symbolically important for the country than his election. Because if he'd been a one-termer and then had lost, I think he would have seen as a historical oddity and, oh, yes, we tried that and it didn't work, et cetera. But the fact that he, in a very, very contentious political time, was able to win comfortable reelection, it was symbolically important. Also, it was practically important as well. Because it meant, for example, that his main legislative achievement or accomplishment, for good or evil, depending on your view, the Affordable Care Act, essentially became permanent. he was able to get enough time in place to avoid it being overturned. He was able to have the diplomatic leeway for the Iran deal, for the climate deal, for other things of that sort. So I think the very fact that we have to – the very fact that most commentary about this speech, for example, is not first African-American president gives final State of the Union address, but just President Obama gives final State of the Union address, it's become the routinization of thinking of him as the president, whether you support him or whether you just detest him. That is a very – it's a symbolic step forward for a country that is always – becoming a broader and more inclusive system.
Mm. James Fallows, our guest this hour, as we respond to the Obama presidency and to the State of the Union address last night. We're going to open phone calls, and we'll do that in just a moment. Many Republicans said what they wanted to hear from the president last night was how he was going to take on ISIS, so we'll move to that conversation, too, in just a few moments. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. James is national correspondent for The Atlantic. He was chief speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. He's the author of, most recently, China Airborne. He lived in China and reported from there for a number of years. He was the founding chair of the New America Foundation, also author of Blind into Baghdad and Postcards from Tomorrow Square. To you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, James Fallows is with us this hour. The President's State of the Union is what we're talking about, and we're beginning our calls with Gerald in Burlington. Hi, Gerald.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to give my voice to the discourse.
Sure.
And I would like to preface my question with thanking Mr. Fallows for his fine investigative reporting work. I hope he can keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much.
The one question I have is I haven't heard anybody as of yet speak about what I feel is a fact, that the reason President Obama is suffering in the polls and in popular opinion is the latent racism that evades our country. I work on construction. Of course, I haven't done any scientific studies, but just anecdotally, there's an awful lot of people that are still harboring those thoughts. And I'd like to see what Mr. Fallows thinks of that.
So certainly some of that is true. And it's impressive to me both that President Obama has made himself not say that during his time in office and just always tried to characterize his opposition in different ways. But I'm sure that once he leaves office and writes, as I imagine he will, about American politics and his time in office, he will reflect upon this point because he must know that it is a component, not the entirety, but a component of his situation. Anyone who knows American history knows that race has been the central axis of our strife. It was the original sin in our foundation, and that's one reason why it was so important to have a non-white, half-African background president win the office twice. So I think it is certainly a component. It's not all of it, and it's one reason why I await President Obama's speeches and memoirs once he leaves office, and he can talk about this more directly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Gerald, for the call. Dennis in Beloit. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, thank you for the program. My call is regarding the Supreme Court. When I watched President Obama's speech, I didn't notice the Supreme Court justices in entirety. I only noted part of the court, and I wondered if that, in fact, was the case. And if so, I'm very disappointed. Unless a justice were ill or there was a family emergency, I sense politics, and in that sense, a very divisive message, in my opinion, to the public. Perhaps mm-hmm. Mr. Fallows can mention if the Supreme Court in entirety was, in fact, there.
I know they weren't there in their entirety. I didn't notice carefully exactly how many were missing. I assume that at least the following two were. Justice Scalia, I think he's made a point over the years that in recent years that he views this as sort of a spectacle that he doesn't want to be involved in. His opinions in recent years have become increasingly less moderate in terms of their the personality he's expressing, and so he's also just said that, you know, he doesn't like being there. Justice Alito, you'll recall that 3 or 4 years ago after the Citizens United decision, President Obama was saying from the State of the Union podium why he thought this was a bad idea, and Justice Alito was very unhappily nodding, no, 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 no. I believe he's not attended any of them since then.
Really?
So I don't know whether any more than those two didn't attend. I didn't notice whether Justice Thomas was there or not. But I think the absence of those two is now taken for granted. And I agree, the politics of the Supreme Court are an unfortunate part of our modern life as they were during the first Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm. And he did make mention of issues that the Supreme Court has had a lot to do with, Citizens United, money and politics, and also making it harder to vote. I didn't see, maybe I was doing something else while the TV cameras were not on the Supreme Court justices and their response to what he had to say, but he brought up those issues.
He did, and there was also a much more pointed line, I thought, where he's talking about the turmoil of the economy, and he said, the only people who can expect to have the same job for 30 years with no change are sitting in this room.
Right.
Now, he might have been including the politicians, but they all at least theoretically stand for election. The only powerful people with life tenure in the United States are on the Supreme Court. I think that's a flaw of our Constitution. I imagine the president does too, and he probably avoided looking right at them during that part, but I have no doubt he met them.
What kind of system do you think we should have, James?
Oh, if I were king?
Sure.
And if I were James Madison, one of many things I would do is we would have the Supreme Court would be staggered 18-year tenures for the 9 members. That would mean that every 2 years a seat would come up, every president would get 2 appointments per term. That would avoid the distortions of people who stay on there for forever and ever and may lose some of their balance or acuity. It's when the Supreme Court was established with life tenure, the life expectancy was 20 years shorter than it is now. It would avoid the distortion now where you try to look for candidates who are as young as you can possibly find them, so that they can have the maximum time on the bench. And essentially, there's no other country that I'm aware of that has life tenure for its supreme judiciary. So I think it's if there was that and the Electoral College would be the first two things I'd change.
Many Republicans before this address said they wanted to hear the president speak about ISIS and how we were taking on ISIS. This is what the president had to say about that. We'll talk with James about what he said about the military and calling on Congress to authorize military action against ISIS. I'm not sure what kind of military action he has in mind, so we'll discuss that. But here's the president last night on ISIS.
Both al-Qaeda and now ISIL pose a direct threat to our people because in today's world, even a handful of terrorists who place no value on human life, including their own, can do a lot of damage. They use the internet to poison the minds of individuals inside our country. Their actions undermine and destabilize our allies. We have to take them out. But as we focus on destroying ISIL, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands. Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages, they pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit. We don't need to build them up to show that we're serious. And we sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions.
James, what do you make of that?
I think on the merits, I personally agree with the case the president is making. Through history, the real threat of terrorism is not the attack, the damage it does itself. It's the overreaction it induces. That is, the worst damage that was done by the 9/11 attackers was not even the horrible destruction in New York. It was provoking the U.S. into invading Iraq. And so the president is trying to say, this is a challenge we need to deal with in the long run without going crazy. And going crazy would mean inflating the threat, the cliched way to put this is, you do the terrorist work for them by magnifying their power and by doing things you shouldn't do in your long-term interest. And I think the case he's making exemplifies both the way he tries to approach problems and the thing that some people don't like about him. It is the way he approaches it is the long term, the long game, that these are the results of tensions that have been building up in the Middle East and the Arab world for a very long time. They've been affected by the disruption of the last decade with Iraq. And it's going to take a long time for them to be resolved. In the meanwhile, there are going to be successes and failures. So I think that's what he is trying to propose. The opposition will say, oh, this is weak, it's inactive, it's passive, it's not responding to fear. And so I think you saw the temperamental difference between the way President Obama is trying to present his policy and what, say, Donald Trump or Ted Cruz would be promoting.
When he's calling on Congress to authorize military action against ISIS, James, what does he want?
What he wants is to have shared political responsibility. I think you and I talked maybe a year ago or so after I'd done this piece in The Atlantic called Chicken Hawk Nation about the way we become a country that is always at war with almost none of the public actually involved in the war. And that's particularly true at the political level, where the Congress never actually takes the required constitutional authority of saying, yes, we authorize this use of our military force. So I think President Obama, to his credit, is asking the Republicans and Democrats in Congress, saying if you're going to talk tough about standing up, talk tough about carpet bombing or boots on the ground, then go on the record. Vote to authorize the use of military force as opposed to just letting it be done out the side door by presidents as it has been done for quite a while.
He also said that we spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. And after he said that, I did ask myself, why?
Well, if you wanted to feel slightly different about it, I think that 10 or 15 years ago, it was more than the next 25 nations combined.
So true.
Some other nations are increasing their spending, too. But he also made the point that any sane assessment of world power shows the United States is incomparably the strongest nation in the world. And you hear all this stuff about we're weak this way or that way. That is just crazy talk. If you look at the actual correlation of forces around the world, actually what the U.S. military can do. And I think he was making that argument not for braggadocio purposes, but to say, let's not go crazy again. We can do whatever we want. So let's think very carefully about where we're going to take the consequential step of asking men and women to die in our name, killing people in our name, disrupting societies. Let's be serious about it.
James Fallows is our guest. We're responding to the President's State of the Union address and welcoming your phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, if you don't want to go on the air, we'd love to read your comments on our page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Steve in Danbury is our next caller. James, hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, Mr. Fallow, thanks for all of your journalistic work over the years. I've always appreciated your writing.
Oh, thank you.
I found the president's speech totally refreshing. We've been inundated with a lot of fear-mongering and negativity with the Republican primary campaign. Just the sheer size of it means that it seems like we're always hearing from one of them, and then, of course, the debates, too. I think Ms. Wasserman Schultz made a big mistake by limiting Democratic debates and putting them at odd hours, so we haven't heard as much from that side. And last night, it was just wonderful to hear a positive vision again. I'm just so thankful that Mr. Obama is the president right now in these trying times. So that's my comment.
Thank you. To respond to two points, I entirely agree with you about the mistake the Democrats are making in their debate strategy. So just on the merits, the Republican race is more interesting this year in the Democratic race. You have such colorful characters. I mean, Donald Trump has made his career for several decades in being a TV performer, and he's really interesting to watch. And you have a very large field. You don't know what's going to happen. So the Republican race would be on the merits just more interesting anyway. But I think the Democrats have done harm to themselves by having, you know, Saturday night at 2 a.m. or whenever it is, having their debates, because there are less histrionics among the candidates. But I think it's better for that party as a whole to say that they all that these are grounded people who agree on some things and disagree on others. On the optimism point, this is really fascinating to me. Again, I worked for Jimmy Carter long ago. The Republican view of that era and the Reagan time that succeeded it is that Carter was too downcast and morose. He never used the word malaise, but he was seen as a downer guy, whereas Reagan was happy and optimistic and sunny and made Americans think they could do anything again. Interestingly now, we have a Democratic president whose argument in this speech is, look, this economy has problems, but it is by far the strongest one in the world. Our military has challenges, but it is, without any comparison, the strongest one in the world. The United States has more international influence now than it did 10 years ago, than most times through its history. So why are we going crazy? And the Republican argument being fire, brimstone, things, you know, malaise would seem like the palest possible thing to be describing. So there's been an interesting psychological flop or reversal of the party's position, which I haven't seen a full explanation for it yet, but it did strike me in relationship to what you're saying.
And what about the voters, James? Will we vote on the basis of our optimism, or are we so mad this year so we're flocking to Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and Bernie Sanders for different reasons for those candidates? But the anger that we have is what will motivate us, not how we look forward to a great, wonderful future.
I guess we will see. As they say, that's why they actually count the votes as opposed to just having the polls. And inevitably, when these races come down to the actual last week or last day and you have to go to the polling booth, there are two impulses which sometimes line up and sometimes are at cross purposes. One is the actual head-to-head choice. It's going to be either on one side, Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or Chris Christie or whoever you might name, and on the other side, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley or whoever else it is, or Joe Biden. And there'll be a very particular, not is one of these people ideal, but if you compare Donald Trump to Bernie Sanders, which one do you like less? Which one do you fear more, et cetera? The other is the dynamic of how you think things are going generally. And if you think, well, the course we're on is a bad one or the course we're on is a good one, sometimes those things line up. But I think that this time there's going to be, I would think, the relative head-to-head comparisons of what would a President Trump mean? What would a President Cruz mean? What would a President Clinton mean? I think those will be relatively more important 10 months from now than they seem now.
Thanks very much, Steve, for your call. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Jake.
I was listening to another program earlier this morning, and Travis Smiley was on it, and he was asked to comment on the address, State of the Union address. And he mentioned that Martin Luther King Jr. often talked about the three most important things to concern oneself with is racism, poverty, and militarization. And he sees President Obama failing to deal with those three things. He sees the entire government failing to deal with these three things.
James.
So racism, poverty, and militarization. I think if you were asking President Obama, he would say that's what he's been trying to deal with in various ways, among other issues, international relations, climate, et cetera, which wasn't on the horizon when Martin Luther King was around. And so, again, you have the real panorama of American politics that The president would argue that his health care plan, for example, was an important anti-poverty measure and also an anti-racism measure because the people who had been most excluded from health care were the poor and often racial minorities. He would say that what he's been talking about in trying to bring focus on police issues in the last year or two and also gun issues involves also people who are poor and victims of or racial discrimination. Militarization, he would argue, has been trying to stay out of war. So I think that people could fault the president for not succeeding on those grounds. I think he would challenge the argument that he'd not been trying and also the argument that anybody else, especially the Republican leadership, had been trying any harder.
James Fallows, our guest this hour, and we're responding to the president's last State of the Union address last night. James, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He was tweeting and doing part of The Atlantic blog on the president's address, which is well worth reading. He also wrote a piece in The Atlantic on December 13th, I believe it was, that looked at the president and... Let me find it exactly. Well, I don't know where it is. But it was a look at whether or not he was a chess master or a pawn, and it was a very interesting analysis, as only James can do. He's good. He's very good at what he does. All right, we'll go back to phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. Our Facebook page, please, if you can't get on the air, send us your messages there, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. James Fallows is here this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Scott in La Crosse is next. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Allow me to add my my voice to the chorus here praising Mr. Fallows. I just have long admired the stuff you've written, and some of your aircraft writing is some of the best I've ever read. So thank you for all of that. What I would like to ask about is I heard commentators this morning on NPR Morning Edition saying that they thought that Donald Trump and both the president's remarks sort of obliquely referring to Trump, and then Governor Haley's responses in the Republican address would provide Donald Trump with a lot of campaign material that he would be able to use this to really blast where both parties are as far as the traditional elements. And do you see that as well?
Yes. First, thanks for your kind words, and I appreciate the aviation note if you're actually calling from Oshkosh, where I've flown many times for the Air Venture Festival in the summer.
Oh.
On whether – I have a little Cirrus SR-22 airplane, which was made by the brothers, Klapmeyer Brothers, originally from Baraboo in Wisconsin, then Duluth.
Huh.
On the way that Trump – that the speeches last night may affect Trump, yes, comma, but. I think that among the, say, 30% or so of the Republican primary electorate who seem to be very loyal to Donald Trump, the idea that both the president – and the established Republican spokesperson for the night were beating up on Trump, I think that will rally them all the more so. And if Trump is saying the two big parties are the same, we need a different approach, I think this will embolden them. But the real problem for the Trump campaign, in my view, as somebody who does not support him as a potential president, is that the more intensely you motivate this 30%, the more difficult it becomes to reach more than 30%, whether you're talking either about the Republican nomination or let alone a general election victory. So I think this could provide some short-term fodder and motivation for the Trump group, and maybe the president even had this in mind, but I think it will come at increasing the difficulty they would have at broadening their coalition.
Mm. Thank you, Scott, so much. Lorraine in Minnesota, hi.
Hi. I'm interested to ask, why has the discussion of our president's race not occurred, either at the public level or I don't know, I don't hear my neighbors talking about the fact that he's a black man, and there are people around here that don't like black people. Why has that, you know, in the face of Black Lives Matter and Ferguson and the overall tenor of our country, why has that not appeared in the discussion?
It's an interesting question. I guess my answer would be, in a way, a version of the elephant in the room phenomenon. The fact that it is so fundamentally obvious a fact about his historical role and his place in office, that in a way it doesn't need to be discussed. I was living in China at the time of his first election, and there the people, that was the only thing they could talk about. Is it possible that America could actually elect a non-white candidate? Certainly when he was running, a lot of the political handicapper discussion was, is it possible that the United States will actually elect this, or are people elect a non-white person, or are they lying in the polls? So I think that the fact that people are not discussing this every day right now, 7 years into his administration, is a sign of – that's actually a sign of the success symbolically of his reelection, that people now take for granted that an American president does not have to be a white man.
Mm. Let's talk about – I don't want to play all of it because we're almost out of time and I want to stay with you. But I thought that the end of his speech was very moving, James. What did you think?
Oh, I'm waiting to hear it. Yes, I think that
it's... Oh, no, we're not going to play it because we're almost
okay.
out of time.
Yes, I think that he's... that was the place I thought he was most explicitly calling back to his 2004 convention speech about the way in which he thought, you know, the whole theme of this ending was that we have to remake our politics so it reflects the best in us, not the worst of us, and he was seeing all these possibilities. And that was, I think, the way Obama wished he could have governed all the way along. Mm-hmm. As the leader of a united community, and our community is not such that he can lead it in that way, but he was saying, wouldn't it be nice to think so?
Mm. Lorraine, thanks for your call. Dan in Wausau, hi.
Hi. I know we're short on time. I'll take my answer off the air. I would like your guest's insight onto maybe what the future would bring. I know President Obama only has one more year to go. No matter who gets elected as president, the gridlock is just unbelievable in Washington. And as voters, taxpayers, and citizens of the United States, does he see anything changing down the line? No matter who gets elected, can we just keep on going on this course for a long time and really not do irreparable harm to this country? And I'll take his comments off the air. Thanks,
Dan.
Thanks for that question. The short answer is I'm finishing right now a cover story for the March issue of The Atlantic, which more or less addresses this very theme. Part of its argument is that America is in really pretty good shape except at the level of national politics. And we have a number of structural failures in national politics now. We have to find some way to surmount. I think in practical terms, our national governance is likely to be more or less paralyzed at least for the next 6 years. When the House is redistricted. Right now, as you probably know, the Republicans have a large majority in the House, even though more Democrats voted for House candidates than Republicans because of the gerrymandering that was put into effect after the last census. That has a chance to be redone in for the 2022 election. I think that's the next time we can look for some structural shift, actually the responsiveness of the government.
Mm. So you don't think that in any national way we'll be taking on bipartisan districting?
I am from California originally. My state, which has its problems, has set a very good example in having nonpartisan districting. And so if this can spread from the California to more states and avoid the excesses, especially of Ohio and Pennsylvania this last time, and having a I think that is a step in the right direction. But by law, the next time it will actually kick in is after the next census, which happens, of course, in 2020. So we need to work for more functioning national politics. In the sort of coldest-eyed way, I think it's going to be a few more years of the kind of thing we're enduring now.
Okay. We have about 45 seconds, but I'm going to do one more call. Mark in Wausau. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to bring up that I'm pretty sure the reason the DNC is scheduling their debates at these really odd hours is because they're scared to death of Bernie Sanders, and they do not want him to be known by the American people because he's about 10,000 times better than whatever her name is.
Whatever her name is, right.
That could have been their intention. If so, I think it's backfired because my view of these debates, and the polling seems to support it, is that approval for all three of the Democratic candidates goes up during these debates. They all acquit themselves better by appearing on stage. And so I think probably what you suggest may have been the motivation for the DNC. I think it's a mistake.
Mm. James, always a great pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. And you have a lot of fans.
Oh, Kathleen, thanks. I'm a big fan of the Upper Midwest. My wife is from Minnesota, so I give greetings to all my people.
It's a lot of your people are listening, James. James Fallows, our guest this hour. James is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He is the author of several books. His latest, China Airborne, Blind into Baghdad, is another of his books, Postcards from Tomorrow Square. And if you're looking for analysis of the presidential State of the Union address last night, The Atlantic, they had a lot of different people do a blog with their reaction to what the president had to say from many different political viewpoints, too, and it's interesting to read. James was among them. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks very much for listening. News ahead from National Public Radio, and we'll return.